Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, Pete Musto, and John Russell. Dr. Jill Robbins is back with another episode of Ask a Teacher. And we close our program with part 3 of Jack London's Love of Life. But first, here is Susan Shand.
United States President Donald Trump became the first U.S. president to attend the yearly March for Life demonstration on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The March for Life movement started in the 1970s to oppose the legalization of abortion operations, which end pregnancies. As thousands of movement supporters looked on, Trump told the crowd, "Unborn children have never had a stronger defender in the White House." He added, "I am proud to stand with you." Following his short speech, some activists chanted, "Four more years." Trump's speech took place at a difficult time for his presidency. Democratic representatives from the House are making their final statements for removing him from office in the nearby Senate building. Trump has become a strong supporter of the movement against abortion, although he supported abortion rights years before seeking office. During his 2016 campaign for president, he promised to appoint Supreme Court justices who would support a change to the court's decision legalizing abortion. Since his election, he has appointed 2 conservative justices to the court, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Conservatives have a 5-4 majority on the court. The March for Life began in 1973 after the U.S. Supreme Court established a woman's constitutional right to an abortion in its Roe v. Wade decision. Abortion remains one of the most disputed issues in the United States. Many abortion opponents say their religious beliefs cause them to protest it as an immoral act. Abortion supporters say the medical operation is protected by the Constitution. They say abortions give women control over their bodies and futures. Other sympathetic U.S. presidents have not attended the march. Republicans Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush both sent recorded messages from other places. Trump did the same in 2017 and also sent video messages in 2018 and 2019. Vice President Mike Pence has attended all 3 marches since he took office. However, he missed this year's event because of a meeting with Pope Francis in Rome. In June, the Supreme Court is expected to rule on a case that could limit doctors' ability to provide abortions in the southern state of Louisiana. The case will test if the High Court will accept laws limiting abortion that are supported by Republicans. Similar laws have been approved by legislatures in several states. I'm Susan Shand.
New York City, the birthplace of hip-hop music, is thousands of kilometers away and culturally very different from northeastern Thailand. But for Thai rapper Ratchio, the language of hip-hop is universal. The 18-year-old artist appears in a recent music video recorded in a rice field. Ratchio is sitting on an old truck, rapping about trouble in a love relationship. The video has 57 million views on YouTube. "I rap about things that really happened to me," Ratchio told the Reuters news agency. Based in Thailand's Nakhon Ratchasima province, the rapper says he mostly sings about girls. The rising popularity of hip-hop in Thailand has created stars that have drawn the attention of music industry leaders. Def Jam Recordings is the main hip-hop label of Universal Music Group, or UMG, one of the world's three major music corporations. Def Jam produces and publishes the work of some of the most popular hip-hop artists in the United States, including Rihanna, 2 Chainz, and Kanye West. Last year, it opened offices in Thailand and Singapore. One of the first artists the company employed after expanding there was Thai rapper Da Boy Way. Da Boy Way has 1 million followers on the social media service Instagram and is releasing a new album on Monday. Def Jam has also made agreements with 5 others from Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Paul Sirisan heads the label's operations in Bangkok. He says Def Jam plans to employ 4 more Thai artists this year. Sirisan noted Thai artists stand out from others in Southeast Asia because the language already includes sounds that rhyme in daily speech. Rhyming, or using words or phrases that end in the same sounds, is a major element of hip-hop. "So rapping in Thai sounds natural," he says. The music has spread outside the nation's major cities. Thailand has already tipped in a big way. "It's the paddy fields and hip-hop," Sirisan said. He adds that highly successful rappers can earn millions of dollars in Thailand. In 2018, Thai media company broadcaster Workpoint Entertainment launched a television program called The Rapper. Non-professional performers compete in the show to become the next rap star. The popularity of The Rapper helped connect the public and hip-hop. A group called Rap Against Dictatorship released a song in 2018 that received millions of views on YouTube. The song included the lyric, "Either eat the truth or bullets," and criticized the military rule of the country. That rule ended in 2019. Other new rap in Thailand comes from 19 Tiger and Henry. Their song, Klong Doi, is about life in a poor Bangkok neighborhood of the same name. Maya Piapan, 23, says his hip-hop group, Warp Gang, met over the internet and has members from across the country. The group, which will perform on January 31st, raps about getting into trouble and problems fame can cause among friends. "Labels have reached out to me to help with production and content, but not as an artist," said Maya. "Production agreements or record deals are the dream for many artists, but not for Ratchio." His recent video, Knock, The Thai word for bird received 80 million YouTube views, more than Thailand's population of nearly 70 million. He says he raps to express himself, but he is not interested in a record deal with a label. I like being home, in the country. I don't really like to go anywhere, he said. I'm Pete Musto.
Italian scientists reported this week that a volcanic explosion not only killed one person, but turned the victim's brain material into glass. This is the first time that scientists have found that a volcanic eruption produced such an effect. Officials at the Herculaneum archaeology dig reported the finding in the New England Journal of Medicine. Mount Vesuvius erupted almost 2,000 years ago in the year 79. The eruption killed people in the nearby cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. The remains of a man lying on a wooden bed were discovered in Herculaneum in the 1960s. He is believed to have been the custodian or caretaker of a place of worship, the Collegium Augustalium at Herculaneum. A report describing the discovery noted that archaeologists rarely find brain tissue in ancient human remains. When they do, the tissue is usually smooth. A team led by Pier Paolo Petroni examined the man's remains. Petroni is with the Federico II University in Naples. He and his team discovered that the victim's brain matter had been vitrified. Vitrification is a process by which tissue is burned at a high heat and turned into glass. A study of burned wood found near the remains suggested that the heat reached temperatures as high as 520 degrees Celsius. A sudden drop in temperatures followed the burst of extreme heat, which vitrified the brain material, the report said. The resulting mass found in the victim's chest bones is also unique among other archaeological sites. The report said the finding could be compared with victims of more recent historic events, like the firebombing of the German cities Dresden and Hamburg in World War II. I'm John Russell.
Today, we answer a question from Vietnam. How can I improve my English listening skill? Nha, Vietnam. Dear Nha, first, thank you for writing and asking your question. It may help to know that there are three kinds of listening. Most of our listening is done person to person or face to face. You can see the other person and ask questions if you do not understand what is being said. This is called interactive listening. At other times, one listens for information, like an announcement coming from a loudspeaker at a train station. What train is leaving now? And from which train platform or gate? If you just hear the names of cities where the train will stop, you might have the information you need. This is selective listening. Today we talk about these two forms of listening, Next time, we will talk about the third kind of listening used in learning. It is called intensive listening. In face-to-face conversations, some things are helpful. First, the person with the information you need is right in front of you. You can ask the speaker to slow down or stop them and ask questions. If you do not understand, stop the other person and ask, "Can you explain this?" You may ask, "Would you please speak more slowly?" When the other person finishes speaking, say what you think about the subject. This will help to show the other person you understand. When you need to get information from an announcement, think first of what you will hear. At a train station, the announcer often identifies the train by a number. The announcer also says where the train is going, the platform it is leaving from, and the time it will leave. The announcement may sound like this: "Train 849 to Washington is leaving from platform B2 at 10 o'clock. Listen for the information you need. When you hear the city you want, listen carefully and you will probably hear the gate number. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 3.
The man had brought his gun half the distance to his shoulder before he realized what he was doing. He lowered it and drew his hunting knife from its cover. Before him was meat and life. He ran his finger along the edge of the knife. It was sharp. The point was sharp. He would throw himself on the bear and kill it. But his heart began its pounding. Then came its wild leap, and he began to feel faint. His wild courage was replaced by a great fear. In his weakness, what if the animal attacked him? He drew himself up tall, grasping the knife and staring hard at the bear. The bear advanced a couple of steps and stood up. If the man ran, the bear would run after him. But the man did not run. He was alive now with the courage of fear. The bear moved away to one side with a threatening noise. He himself was fearful of this strange creature that appeared unafraid. But the man did not move. He stood still until the danger was past. Then he yielded to a fit of trembling and sank to his knees on the wet grass. He regained control of himself and then started to move forward, afraid now in a new manner. It was not the fear that he would die from lack of food. He was afraid that he would be destroyed by forces other than starving. There were the wolves. Across the wasteland, their howls could be heard, making the air itself a threat most real to him. Now and again the wolves in groups of two and three crossed his path, but they stayed away from him. They were not in sufficient numbers to attack, and besides, they were hunting caribou. Caribou did not battle, while this strange creature that walked on two legs might bite. In the afternoon he came upon scattered bones where the wolves had made a kill. What remained had been a young caribou an hour before. He studied the bones, cleaned of any flesh. They were still pink with the life in them, which had not yet died. Might he look like that before the day was done? Was this life a fleeting thing without meaning? It was only life that pained. There was no hurt in death. To die was to sleep. It meant rest. Then why was he not content to die? But he did not think about these things for very long. He was soon seated in the grass, a bone in his mouth, biting at the bit of life that made it yet pink. The sweet, meaty taste drove him mad. He closed his teeth firmly on the bones. Sometimes it was the bone that broke, sometimes his teeth. Then he crushed the bones between the rocks. He pounded them into tiny pieces and ate them. He was in such a hurry that he pounded his fingers, too. He felt surprised at the fact that his fingers did not hurt much when they were caught under the rock. Then came frightful days of snow and rain. He did not know when he made camp and when he broke camp. He traveled in the night as much as in the day. He rested whenever he fell, moving ahead whenever the dying life in him started up again. He, as a man, no longer struggled. It was the life in him, unwilling to die, that drove him on. He did not suffer, nor feel pain, but his mind was filled with hallucinations and wild dreams. But he still ate the crushed bones of the young caribou, which he had gathered and carried with him. He crossed no more hills, but followed a large stream which flowed through a wide valley. He did not see this stream, nor this valley. He saw nothing except hallucinations. One morning he awakened with his mind clear, lying on his back on a rocky surface. The sun was shining bright and warm. Far away he heard the noises made by the young caribou. He remembered rain and wind and snow. But whether he had been beaten by the storm for 2 days or 2 weeks, he did not know. For some time he lay without movement. The friendly sun poured down upon him and filled his body with its warmth. A fine day, he thought. Perhaps he could succeed in locating himself. By a painful effort, he rolled on his side. Below him flowed a wide river. Its unfamiliarity puzzled him. Slowly he followed it with his eyes as it curved among the bare hills. They were more bare and lower than any hills he had yet seen. Slowly, without excitement, he followed the course of the strange stream toward the skyline and saw that it emptied into a bright and shining sea. He was still unexcited. Most unusual, he thought. It was probably a trick of his mind. He was certain of this when he also saw a ship floating in the shining sea. He closed his eyes for a while, then opened them. It was strange how the sight continued, yet it was not strange. He knew there were no seas or ships in the middle of this land, as he had known there was no cartridge in the empty gun. He heard a noise behind him. It seemed like the dry sound that comes from the throat when air is forced out in a cough. Very slowly, because of his weakness and stiffness, he rolled to his other side. He could see nothing near, but he waited patiently. Again came the cough, and there, between two rocks, he saw the gray head of a wolf. The sharp ears did not stand up as straight as he had seen them on other wolves. The eyes were dull, and the head seemed to hang. The animal opened and shut its eyes frequently in the sunshine. It seemed sick. As he looked, it coughed again. This was real, he thought. He turned on the other side to see the reality of the world which had been hidden from him before by his hallucination. But the sea still shone, and the ship was still there. Was it reality? He closed his eyes for a long while and thought. And then he remembered. He had been traveling north by east, away from the Deese Divide and into the Coppermine Valley. This wide river was the Coppermine. That shining sea was the Arctic Ocean. That ship was a fishing boat which had wandered east from the mouth of the Mackenzie River. Now it was lying in Coronation Gulf. He remembered the map that he had seen long ago, and it was all clear and reasonable to him. He sat up and turned his attention to immediate affairs. He had worn holes through the blanket wrappings, and his feet were like shapeless pieces of meat. His last blanket was gone. His gun and knife were both lost. He had also lost his hat somewhere, with the matches and the band. The matches against his chest were safe and dry inside the paper. He looked at his watch. It marked 11 o'clock and was still going. This proved that he had kept it wound. He was calm. Although very weak, he had no feeling of pain. He was not hungry. The thought of food was not even pleasant to him. Whatever he did was done entirely by reasoning. He tore off the legs of his trousers to the knees and bound them about his feet. Somehow he had succeeded in keeping the tin container. He would have some hot water before he began what he knew was to be an awful journey to the ship. His movements were slow. He shook as if with a disease. When he started to gather dried grasses, he found he could not rise to his feet. He tried again and again. Then he contented himself with moving about on his hands and knees. Once he went near the sick wolf. The animal dragged itself out of the way, licking its face with a tongue which seemed hardly to have the strength to curl. The man noticed that the tongue was not the customary healthy red, but was a yellowish-brown and covered with a half-dried coating. After he drank some hot water, the man found he was able to stand. He could even walk as well as a dying man might be supposed to walk. But every minute or two he was forced to rest. His steps were unsteady, as were the steps of the wolf behind him. That night, when the shining sea was hidden in the blackness, he knew he was nearer to it by no more than 4 miles. Through the night he heard the cough of the sick wolf, now and then the noises of the young caribou. There was life all around him, but it was strong life, very much alive and well. He knew the sick wolf was following the sick man's steps in the hope that the man would die first. In the morning, when he opened his eyes, he saw it looking at him with a hungry stare. It stood with its tail between its legs like an unhappy dog. The sun rose brightly, and all morning the man headed toward the ship on the shining sea. The weather was perfect. It was the brief return of summer which was usual in that country. Might continue for a week, or tomorrow or the next day it might be gone.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories and information from around the world. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.